my blood starts circulating. Do your chest have elasticity? Did they cut off your electricity? Did you scream in your... And we're back. No, we're not back. We're here for the first time, aren't we? It's kind of hard to begin this without the theme, but it seems to have disappeared around here, so we'll have to work on a replacement. Welcome to Behind the News for July 18, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two segments, interview segments, scheduled tonight for tonight. First, we'll speak with Pratap Chatterjee, who is a freelance journalist, investigative journalist, about... a subsidiary of a company that Dick Cheney used to run, Brown & Root, which is a construction company, which has made a fortune contracting with the U.S. military around the world, and it continues to do so, and with some attention being paid to accounting shenanigans that went on at Halliburton during Dick Cheney's reign. It's also worth looking at some other things that Halliburton was up to. So we'll hear from Pratap Chatterjee in a few minutes. And then we'll hear from Heather Boucher of the Economic Policy Institute, author of a recently published report, Staying Employed After Welfare, Work Supports, and Job Quality, Vital to Employment, Tenure, and Wage Growth. One of the few attempts to look at what happens to people after they leave welfare. And we'll talk to Heather also about what's going on with welfare reauthorization and the politics of all that. But before we get to that, just a couple of observations, news announcements. First of all, in the U.S. economy, which continues to be a fascinating story, not just about scandal and fraud and all those exciting things, but also the economy is still struggling to get up off the mat. It was reported this morning that initial claims for unemployment insurance, which is a very sensitive and early measure of what's going on with the job market, those unemployment claims declined, and they have been on a gentle downtrend for the last few weeks. So that's a good sign. It means that fewer people are losing their jobs, but there's also not much sign that hiring is picking up. So that's one part of the equation is that there are fewer jobs disappearing, but the other side is that there aren't that many new jobs appearing. So we'll be continuing to follow that. Two other reports came out this morning, which are not exactly the most upbeat news. First of all, the Philadelphia branch of the Federal Reserve does a monthly survey of manufacturing conditions in its region, which is the Middle Atlantic region, New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania. A fairly important industrial region, although not the most important industrial region in the U.S., and they're finding that factory output in their particular neighborhood declined last month. It expanded at a slower rate. So the index declined, but it's still showing a mildly expanding manufacturing economy. But it took most people by surprise. It is showing a less vigorous pace of expansion than most market analysts expected. It also shows that employment in the manufacturing sector is continuing to decline, also a weakening of new orders. So you know, Wall Street is obsessed with these early reports. This is one of them. There's another one that will come out on August 1st, a survey of purchasing managers, who are the people in companies who buy stuff, which is also a very a sensitive early indicator. And we'll see what that's doing. But it looks like manufacturing, which had a very, very brutal recession in the years 2000 and 2001 and looked like it was recovering earlier this year, there's a little doubt that that recovery's strength. And then also, ABC News and Money Magazine do a joint weekly poll of consumer attitudes. They call it their Consumer Comfort Index. It also is supposedly an early sign of what's happening with consumer spending and things like that. It's not been around for more than 5 or 6 years, so it doesn't have a great track record, but it also is showing American consumers to be in a less upbeat mood. It is a negative number, and has, as it has been for several months now. There was a sign of recovery early in the year, especially between February and March and early April, but has been tending downwards ever since. And certainly all the scandals and the stock market troubles and everything are certainly not contributing to any sense of upbeat revival. And they ask in the course of putting together this poll, people what their evaluations of the national economy, the state of their personal finances, and the state of their personal finances has improved very marginally over the last several months, but not by very much. And their evaluation of The national economy is deteriorating, has been deteriorating in recent weeks as well. So that is not a good sign for any kind of economic recovery. Then, in scandal news, today's Boston Globe reports that the Harvard Endowment Fund poured millions of dollars into Harkin Energy, which is, of course, the company that George W. Bush was connected with in the 1980s. Very mysterious why Harvard University poured a bunch of money into what looked like a losing operation. Nobody's answering any of those questions, but very, very curious indeed. And not only did Harvard pour money into it, so did George Soros, who personally owned about a third of the company as a result of a business deal that left him with Harkin shares. And Soros declined to be interviewed by the Boston Globe for this story. The second was an investor from Saudi Arabia. There's a big question floating around about who bought the Harkin Energy shares that George Bush sold in 1989. Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity asserted in a book published, I believe, last year, that Harvard was the entity that bought them. Chris Caldwell, in his column in New York Press, and it's very good to see him back in New York Press again, speculates that there could be a Saudi connection, and it seems that both Harvard and Saudis were all over Harkin Energy. And we need to, only somebody with subpoena power can answer those questions. And let's hope that somebody in Congress gets really curious and issues some subpoenas. And in further scandal news, an interesting media column by Howard Kurtz in today's Washington Post. And it begins, when Enron collapsed amid spectacular scandal, the New York Times repeatedly assailed the company in editorials for its tangled finances. 5 years ago, it turns out, the New York Times company struck a newsprint swap agreement, a financial deal in which no physical assets changed hands with the very same Houston Energy Company. And these kinds of cashless swap deals are just the kinds of things that Enron engaged in large numbers, the telecommunications companies that went bankrupt engaged in as well. So the prestigious New York Times, which gets its editorial pulpit to denounce the misbehavior of others, didn't really see what its own corporate staff was up to. And Kurtz, fairly enough, takes his own employer to task, the Washington Post, which, as he quotes, an editorial from April saying that current rules which allow companies to grant executives and other employees millions of dollars in stock options without recording a dime of expenses make a mockery of corporate accounts, an editorial position that is quite justified. But the Washington Post company did the same thing, boosting reported income by $3.6 million last year by not counting stock options as a cost of doing business. And when Kurtz asked the Times for a comment, they said, it is inconceivable that anyone will think our journalism was influenced by such a development, of course. It is just inconceivable, isn't it? The Chicago Tribune also said in a March editorial, put stock options on the books. And they denounced the practice of excluding it. Tribune Company, the parent of the Chicago Tribune, did the same thing, didn't count as expenses, the options it granted to its top executives. And the Post, Washington Post chair, Donald Graham, defended its practice because they thought it was the most accurate way of giving financial information to shareholders. As everyone knows, the editorial page writes what it thinks is good policy, and if it varies with newspaper policy or corporate policy, that's fine. And further, Washington Post editorial last month supported as a sensible proposal a bill passed by the Senate this week that would restrict accounting firms' ability to provide consulting services for clients whose books they audit. This is one of the ingredients of the great accounting scandals that are all over the place now, that the accountants are supposed to audit the books. We're also getting fees for consulting services, and who wants to say nasty things about the way the books are done if you're getting fees for consulting services? Well, it turns out that Washington Post Company paid its auditor some fees for consulting services, as did Viacom, Disney, and the New York Times, NGE. So all the media companies have been denouncing these very practices that they've been engaging in. And let's see what else we have here. Oh, yes, in activism news, I guess we can call it that, news from earlier this week. Paraguay imposes a state of emergency amid rioting. Riots in response protests to against the free market policies of a government that's already been forced to backtrack in its privatization plans. So we're having IMF and anti-privatization riots in Paraguay. But it's not alone. Brazil, the leftist Lula, who is making a lot of compromises, but his heritage is definitely in the end of the left end of the spectrum, is heading opinion polls ahead of October's presidential elections. The government of Peru was forced to suspend privatizations due to violent protests last month, and important members of its cabinet resigned. And, of course, Argentina is having its worst economic crisis in many, many decades. So rebellions and problems across Latin America against privatization and the whole neoliberal model. And in a heroic and inspiring story, Nigerian women storm Chevron Texaco, AP reports. Unarmed women stormed four Chevron Texaco oil pipeline stations in southeastern Nigeria and to press their demands that the oil company actually provide them with some jobs and some electricity and not just pollute the country and take the money and run. It's interesting that they're asking for electricity and jobs and not for a return to pre-industrial paradise. They want industrialization. They want to enjoy the benefits of it, not just the nasty end of it. Oh, and one more little bit. Yesterday's Washington Post reports that in the scandal beat that when Dick Cheney left Halliburton, it turned out that he as well sold some stock just before the company was about to issue some bad news. He made a $18.5 million profit selling his shares. 60 days later, the company surprised investors with a warning that its engineering construction business was doing much worse than expected, driving shares down 11% in one day. And about the same time, it announced it was under a grand jury investigation for overbilling the government. And then in months that followed, it became clear that Halliburton had large liability claims for asbestos stemming from a company that Cheney acquired, I believe Dresser Industries it was. And so he got out, sold his shares, and then all hell broke loose at Halliburton. And we'll hear a little bit more about Halliburton in just a moment when we listen to Pratap Chatterjee. Let's take this little musical break, listen to The Coup, and then go straight into the Chatterjee interview.
Did your tanks have elasticity? Did they cut off your electricity? Did you scream and yell explicitly? Force the boss into complicity. I'm a white chalk stencil, but I push a pencil. Rolling dope fiend rentals to your residential. Broke as fuck eating lentils with no utensils. Finna teach pimp class with a whole credential. They own sweatshops, pack cops, and fills of cola. Murder babies with their molars on the areola. Control the Pope, Dalai Lama, holy rollers, and the Ayatollah. Bump this rolling in your bucket or your new Corolla. Or you might catch me on the scenic route.
And that was a bit from the Coos album, Party Music. And I'm not sure whether I should say the title of the song or whether that risks getting us in trouble with the FCC, and God knows I don't want to do that. And now let's turn to an interview I recorded earlier today with Pratap Chatterjee. Pratap Chatterjee is a freelance investigative journalist based in the Bay Area of California and the author of several pieces on the Corp Watch website about Dick Cheney, Brown and Root, and the contracting aspects of the war on terrorism. The Corp Watch website is at www.corpwatch.org. Here's Pratap Chatterjee.
Welcome to WBI. Certainly, Dick Cheney's tenure at Halliburton is getting some press and some official scrutiny, but you've been looking at some aspects that have not been getting quite as much scrutiny. Tell us about Dick Cheney and Brown and Root.
Well, Dick Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense back in the early 1990s, approached military contractors to look at the possibility of privatizing certain aspects of the U.S. Army, non-essential roles, what one might call MASH roles, running kitchens, mess areas, doing the laundry, transporting equipment, and, you know, meeting and greeting people as they arrived at, you know, at a scene of battle. Brown and Root did a proposal and turned it over to the Army, and then Dick Cheney went back to them and said, can you actually come up with a real action plan? And so he paid them more money, they came up with a plan, and then they got the first of what's called LOGCAP, which stands for the Logistics Civilian Augmentation Program. And basically it's using civilians to add logistics capabilities to the army. Now, this initial contract has been renewed twice. So LOGCAP ran for, I think 5 years, and then for another 5 years, and that's been renewed for 10 years. The first contract went to Brown and Root, and the second contract actually went to a rival called DynCorp. However, at that point, Brown and Root was well ensconced in this field, and they were already providing services to the U.S. Army in Bosnia. So effectively, even though they lost the second contract, they implemented what they were already doing. And this, by this time, this contract ballooned into a multi-billion dollar contract, something between in the range of between $2 and $4 billion worth of U.S. Army contracts went to Brown and Root. And this is around about 1996. Now, at this point, Dick Cheney had left the Secretary of Defense. He had left the administration, rather, and had been invited subsequent to a couple of years at a think tank in Washington, D.C., invited to join Brown and Root, or rather its parent company, which is Halliburton, as chief executive officer. So he vastly expanded not just that, but many other government contracts with Brown and Root. And recently, December 2001, when that second LOGCAP contract, the second set of contracts for implementing civilians implementing logistics for the U.S. Army in foreign battlefields, they got a third contract. This third contract is a 10-year contract, and it's open-ended, which means the U.S. Army, which has to report any project which is over $10 million, you know, made a little note on, 16th of December 2001, I think, saying, we're going to give Brown and Root contracts, more than $10 million, but we're not going to specify where, when, or how much. It could be any amount of money. And we've seen those contracts being implemented primarily in what one might call the war of terrorism, or as the administration prefers to call it, the war on terrorism. And one of their first contracts was to set up a base in Uzbekistan, or rather to run a base in Uzbekistan for the U.S. Army that has been the primary place from which troops have entered Afghanistan in the beginning phases of the war.
Well, what's the rationale for all this secrecy? I mean, are they claiming military secrecy? Normally, the stuff is kind of open.
They claim that it's partly they claim it's military secrecy. The thing is, the information is not actually secret. If you ask, it exists and you can find it. They just haven't had any press conferences about it. I mean, I asked. I suspected that there might be something afoot. And when I was recently in Afghanistan, you know, I asked around and nobody was quite sure. So when I came back, you know, I looked up the military contracts and then I called up the army and I said, is it true that Brown and Root is going into the field? And first they said, well, no. And then somebody came back and said, well, we've heard of a contract. And so then I turned to Brown and Root and I said, is it true? This is the 18th of April, I think, of this year. I said, is it true you're going to the Afghanistan theater of operations? Brown and Root said, of course not. We have no such orders. 25th of April, I said, well, the army suggested there is a contract being planned. And so Brown and Root wrote back to me and said, well, you better ask the army. To the best of our knowledge, nothing has happened. On the 26th of April, the day after they wrote to me, they actually arrived in Uzbekistan. So technically, you know, they had told me the truth. They were not in Uzbekistan on the 25th of April. On the 26th of April, however, they were. And as of the 1st of May, they were, you know, on the ground. They had three people there, basically planning to take over this base, which is called Khanabad, from the U.S. Army and run all the logistical operations. As of the 10th of June, I think, they were completely in charge of the base, the logistical side of things.
And is this routine procedure, or why is the Army contracting out to have other people run their bases?
They've actually, this really became routine under Dick Cheney. He started this in giving the contract to Brown and Root in the first place. Until then, I want to backtrack a little bit, because it's not that civilians have not been involved in U.S. Army operations in the past. Brown and Root, for example, built the bases in Vietnam, but they were simply construction contractors. And sure, the U.S. Army hires local cooks to run things, to cook food in its various operations overseas, or maybe they, hire people to move equipment. But it's rare for them to actually give a contract. In fact, this is unprecedented for them to give a contract to a multinational corporation and to actually have that implemented, as part of the Army's set of operations. And this is where it's different. It's actually expanding quite a bit. When during the Gulf War, perhaps 1 in 100 employees in the Gulf War was a civilian contractor. By the time we arrived in Bosnia for the peacekeeping operations, 1 in 10 of these contractors was a civilian. And so, literally, if you were a U.S. soldier and you arrived in Bosnia and you got off a plane, the first person that you met was a Brown and Root employee with a Brown and Root logo that said, "Welcome to Bosnia," showed you to your tent, showed you to your mess hall and your laundry, and was setting up radio towers and what have you. Now, today they're doing that in Uzbekistan. They are also getting contracts currently under a slightly different contract with the Navy to build prisons in Guantanamo Bay for the Taliban prisoners. They've been reinforcing embassies in Albania. All of this is, part of multiple government contracts. Now, a lot of these contracts have been supposedly implemented to save costs. But the fact of the matter is the GAO took a couple of looks at such programs under Brown and Root in Bosnia and discovered that Brown and Root was overcharging the U.S. Army, not necessarily for unnecessarily, but they were buying equipment that they didn't have to. They bought a whole bunch of power generators when they could have leased them, and it cost a cool $100 million to purchase this equipment, which was actually sitting idly and not being used at all.
Do you have any sense of the terms of these contracts? Are they comfortable cost plus contracts, or
they are a cost plus contract? So basically, what happens in these contracts is that Brown & Root submits a proposal and says, "This is what we're going to purchase," and the Army approves it. And once they have implemented this contract, they turn over their receipts to the Army, and then they get a profit margin that's paid to them based on their performance, and it can be as much as 9%. And in fact, Brown & Root has always got the top performance rating, and therefore earn their 9%. So if they charge the U.S. Army $2.5 billion for their work in Bosnia, they made, $225 million in profits on that contract. Without having much at risk at all. No, they're totally protected by the U.S. Army and that kind of thing. Now, there are ways you can actually do... you can be quite creative in the way you build the army. In Bosnia, they were creative in buying a lot of equipment that wasn't necessary, and then, of course, they made their profit on top of it. The GAO noted instances where, they had civilian employees clean offices 4 times a day, which is really unnecessary. But since most of them were doing nothing, and they had to be paid to sit around and do something, they were sent in to do these kinds of jobs. The GAO and the U.S. Army claims to me now, Mike Knoll, who's the guy in charge at the civilian at the army in charge of this operation claims that they've learned a lot from that and they won't be doing that again. But the fact of the matter is that this happened in the past. And I live in the San Francisco area in California, and down south 3 hours from here in Monterey, Brown & Root was hired to shut down a military base, Fort Ord. And when they went in there, they massively overcharged the U.S. government. In fact, as recently as February of this year, the government had a lawsuit against Brown & Root for overcharging when a whistleblower, Damon Campbell, explained how they basically... What they did in this case was they submitted a proposal to the government, and they said, we're going to buy 500 widgets at the cost of $50, just by way of example. And once the Army signed off on that proposal, it's called a contractor's pricing proposal, I think, the Army then gave them a statement of work. And the statement of work doesn't actually specify the number of widgets they're going to buy. It actually specifies what needs to be done. So given that they said that they were going to buy 500 widgets, but they were only required to perform the task but not actually purchase 500 widgets, they went out and purchased 300 widgets because they knew that they could do it with 300 widgets. And they were paid, however, based on a manual that the Army holds, which says, that the Army issues, which says widgets cost $50 each, so 500 costs X number of dollars. However, since they were purchasing less than that, any extra money they made was their profit. And to return to Dick Cheney, a lot of these contracts were obtained under Dick Cheney, but separately, Dick Cheney is now, in fact, Halliburton is being investigated for the time under his watch when a crucial accounting change was made in how Brown & Root, or rather Halliburton, its parent, reports to its shareholders. And what was happening in this case was that in construction contracts, I don't know that this was applied to military contracts, but certainly in construction contracts, what Brown & Root was doing was going to a client and saying, we'll build you a power plant for, say, $100 million. And then coming back to their shareholders and saying, look, this project is probably going to cost $150 million, and therefore we're going to be able to overbill the client for cost, bill the client for cost overruns, and we're going to make an extra $50 million profit. So we're going to be a lot more profitable next year. Now, I don't think it was exactly illegal, but the effect of this was to have their share prices rise because the shareholders thought, well, they're making so much more money, you know, their stock should be worth a lot more because they have all this revenue. But you have to understand that morally, this is a little difficult because you're telling, on the one hand, the client, you're going to charge them less. On the other hand, you're telling the shareholders you're going to earn more money. Nobody's stealing any money out here. Nobody is taking any money from the clients. They shouldn't. They're giving clients a bill, and the clients have to pay the bill. But basically, by telling them different stories, the effect is their share price rises. And this is what the SEC is investigating. Now, back under Cheney's watch, if you look at the contract in Bosnia, once again, the same thing happened. They talked to Congress, and they said to Congress, this is what it's going to cost for our operation in Bosnia. It's going to cost us $300 million, or whatever the number is. And 6 months later, of course, when the bill comes in, it's $500 million. So, again, I'm not sure that the SEC is investigating those reports, because I think what lawmakers and the Army tell Congress is perhaps not necessarily the same as the actual statement of work that's signed between them. That was trying to pretend to Congress that, you know, things are going to cost less, but it's not necessarily a signed contract. But effectively, it's the same thing.
This, of course, the administration is going to bring a higher standard of ethics to Washington. This seems
absolutely
to be
more money to Washington,
right?
From CEOs. I mean, this is really how, it's a revolving door. Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense, then he became CEO of Halliburton. Now he's Vice President. If he makes it through office and survives his heart conditions, I'm sure he'll return to private industry. So their highest standard is really probably to line their pockets even more.
There's an article in the New York Times about a week ago on Brown and Root's military contracts that they suggested that there was some favoritism involved, but they didn't actually come out and say that. Is there any sense that Brown and Root's good luck in contracting has anything to do with Cheney's position?
Well, it's a good question, and when I wrote my piece a couple of months ago, I interviewed a number of people from the Army, and I spoke to Vice President Cheney's office, and they claimed he had nothing to do with it whatsoever. And in fact, the Army people, before I even asked the question...
Sorry, we lost about 10 seconds of material there while the tape was being flipped. Now, back to the program.
There's a Freedom of Information Act request and looks at the Vice President's papers. There's no way one can really tell for sure what happened. And it has certainly been pointed out to me by people in the Army that there are really only two or three contractors that are capable of doing this. And one of them is Brown & Root, another is DynCorp. But it's not like they were somebody who came out of nowhere to snag a contract that they were not capable of or had never done. However, the thing that I think people are really sort of not looking at is the kind of money that Dick Cheney has made, you know, at Brown & Root. Sure, he may not have signed contracts directly with the government or lobbied them for it, but they brought him in knowing full well what his position was, the people he could introduce him to, them to, and then they gave him, you know, major stock options. And when he left Halliburton, he left with $30 million plus in cash from cashing in the stock options. So the U.S. Army did not pay Dick Cheney directly for these contracts, and so he never made a profit directly from the U.S. Army. No bribery was involved. Maybe no pieces of paper, you know, were filed away indicating conversations took place. But it was, I guess, what one might call a quid pro quo. You know, you do this for us, we'll make sure we'll take care of you, you know, when you retire. So,
and of course, winks and nods can do all that work. And when it happens in Asia, they call it crony capitalism, right?
I think we probably invented it.
I think you're right. Thanks for joining us, Pratap.
You're welcome, Doug.
And that was an interview I recorded earlier today with Pratap Chatterjee, who is an investigative independent journalist based in the Bay Area of California. And again, you can find his articles about Dick Cheney and Halliburton and Brown and Root and such on the Corp Watch website, which is www.corpwatch.org, C-O-R-P-W-A-T-C-H. And you can search for his name, Chatterjee, C-H-A-T-T-E-R-J-E-E, although I suppose you can also search for Halliburton, which might be a little easier to spell for a native English speaker than Chatterjee. And this is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And we'll speak in just a moment with Heather Boucher from the Economic Policy Institute. But just an observation here. The Swiss reinsurance company, Swiss Re, reinsurance is basically insurance for insurance companies. If you take out a policy with an insurer, it hedges its own risk by taking out an insurance policy that it's not going to have to pay you off. And so that's what reinsurance is. Anyway, Swiss Re published a report yesterday on the issue of climate change. And years ago, well, I think when I was first doing this program, I interviewed a couple of people about this issue. Swiss Re, along with another reinsurance company, Munich Re, the German reinsurer, they're both very concerned about the risks of climate change, and they have a very material interest in that. If there are a lot of storms, for example, caused by an unruly climate, and then they're going to have to pay off a lot of claims, and they don't like that idea. But they're turning to a certain degree of political propagandizing about climate change. Very interesting split in the business world, with at least the European reinsurance industry pushing for some action on global warming because they don't have to pay the bills for it. The U.S. insurance industry remains rather asleep on this issue. And, of course, the U.S. oil industry remains deathly opposed to doing anything about global warming. The report itself from Swiss Re is not terribly interesting, but the very fact that a reinsurance company should take a public position that there's something to be worried about when it comes to climate change is very, very interesting. And if you want to get their report and see what else they've had to say on the issue, they're also on the web at SwissRe.com. And now we're joined on the line by Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C., and author of a paper recently published by EPI, Staying Employed After Welfare. And Heather's been studying what determines the fate of people who lose their welfare check and get a job and how well they do afterwards. Welcome to WBAI, Heather.
Thank you, Doug. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
And it's been way too long.
Way too long.
Yes, and thank you for taking your time out from a very busy schedule producing The State of Working America, which is something that EPI publishes every other Labor Day, and I guess this is a State of Working America year.
That it is.
And I won't, of course, ask you to break the embargo and tell us what's in it, but we may inadvertently touch on some topics.
I'm sure we will touch on some of them.
But first of all, let's talk about your report, Staying Employed After Welfare. At least during the boom, there was a great lot of chest puffing about the alleged success of welfare reform, mainly because the roles were declining and it seemed that the people who were leaving the welfare roles were getting jobs. What do we know about their success in getting jobs and in keeping them?
Well, we do know that the majority, a slight majority, about 60% of folks who've left welfare have found jobs, although with the recession over the past year and a half, it's highly likely that many of them have lost their jobs and either found new jobs and some of them have moved back onto the welfare rolls. But one of the things that we had been looking at in our research over the past year was not just whether or not folks moved off of welfare and found a job, but what it took to help them keep those jobs once they found them. You know, in many states, they did these programs to really push welfare recipients off the rolls as quickly as possible and under the logic that any job was better than no job at all. And these Work First programs, and I know that New York City had a program that really encouraged people to take any job rather than staying on welfare, to get an education or to search for the best possible job, but to really take that first job out there. And that was one of the things that we wanted to evaluate and see, well, is that really the best way to get people into the labor market and to get them to keep those jobs over the long term?
What do we know about the kinds of jobs that people got when they left welfare?
Well, most of the jobs that people got were in the low-wage labor market. They make about $6 to $8 an hour. Many of them are in retail. About a sixth of them are in eating and drinking places. They're waiters, they're waitresses, they're working in restaurants. Another sixth of them are working in retail generally. A lot of them are working in what are sort of broadly called the caring labor professions, home health aides, child care workers, nursing assistants, folks that sort of provide that kind of caring labor at the very low end of the labor market. And then a lot of them were temporary workers, and that was one of the sectors that has been hit hardest by the recession and where we've seen the most job losses. So a lot of those workers were likely to have lost their jobs.
And what determines people's fate in employment after leaving welfare?
Well, there's really two critical issues. And the first one is that getting folks into a good job is key. The higher a worker's starting wages, the more likely they are to keep their job. And really critically, if the job provides the formal welfare recipient with employer-provided health insurance, she's much more likely to keep that job than if she finds a job that doesn't have that. Over 2.5 times as likely, in fact, to still be employed 2 years later if the first job she found had employer-provided health insurance.
Now, my guess is that McDonald's and Walmart and such don't provide really an awful lot of health insurance. So how many of these workers really enjoyed that benefit?
Yeah, it's really very few. You know, generally among the kinds of industries and occupations that welfare recipients find jobs, it's less than a third, about a third, find jobs that have employer-provided health insurance. So it's not a lot of people, but it really can make the difference between staying in the labor market and not. So it's something that we really need to be thinking about in terms of policy, and also the wage story is also very important. The other side of the coin, though, is that it's not just about what happens in the labor market that's important for low-wage women and former welfare recipients, but it's their ability to balance their family responsibilities with holding down a full-time job. And so the other thing that we looked at was whether or not access to child care subsidies or help with child care payments would help moms stay in the labor market. And we found that mothers who received some sort of help with child care payments were nearly twice as likely to still be employed 2 years later as women who did not. So that's sort of the second major factor in helping people stay employed, is helping them balance their family responsibilities while they're working.
Now, on the wage issue, you say in the report that women who start their jobs earning in the top fifth of women earners are twice as likely to be employed after 2 years as women who started in the bottom fifth.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get so lucky to find high-wage jobs after leaving welfare?
Well, I think those numbers are actually looking at women overall, but it's even true when you just look at comparing low and lower-wage workers. If you look at women in the bottom fifth of the labor market and compare them to women in the second to bottom fifth of the labor market, among former welfare recipients, they're 60% more likely to still be employed 2 years later if they got a job just in that second to bottom quintile, second bottom fifth of the labor market. So how do we get them into those jobs? Well, I think that's actually the $6 million question there. In some states, the welfare-to-work programs have really encouraged caseworkers to help welfare recipients both train for better-paying jobs, but also encourage them to wait and to do a real good job search so they find the best job and the job that's most in line with their skills and a job that provides them with upper mobility. The best example of this is a program that happened out in Portland, Oregon, over the past few years that was really very successful in getting people into higher-paying jobs because they took the time to help welfare recipients find them rather than providing sanctions or just real disincentives to staying on welfare. In these cases, in Portland, they were encouraging people to stay on welfare until they found the best job.
Now, was that just an experiment, or was this a broader state policy?
It was an experiment in Portland, it was implemented also in other parts of the state subsequently because it was so effective.
But what about other jurisdictions around the country? It seems that the driving force behind welfare reform was not helping people, but saving money and providing a moral lesson for everyone else. How much of this kind of more supportive environment have we seen?
We've seen very little of it, unfortunately. And part of it is that welfare reform was implemented during the best economy that this country's seen in the past 50 years. So there wasn't, folks were able to move off the welfare rolls quickly, and it's hard to see the problem in some states. Well, folks are moving off, and if they're finding jobs, if they're low-wage jobs, why should state welfare offices be concerned about whether or not they keep their jobs if the economy is so good? But now with the economies are pulling back, with higher unemployment, especially higher unemployment among workers with less education and among minority workers, it's likely that these kinds of programs, like in Portland, are going to be looked at a little bit closer in states that don't have such programs because it's going to become more important for them to help people stay in the labor market. States are going to have to work harder, basically.
Of course, with the recession, a lot of states and cities are facing big holes in their budgets, and so they're not likely to want to begin an expensive program to support poor people, are they?
Well, no. And what we've been seeing over the past year is that cases have been rising in many states. In fact, a slight majority of states' caseloads have risen. And in these states, you have seen some pulling back on a lot of the more generous work support programs, the programs that were offering child care support or transportation assistance in order to pay for rising caseloads. And so money is being diverted from the very kinds of programs that would help people stay employed because state budgets are being pinched, and this is a real problem right now. It's also related to the whole debate going on here in Washington in terms of reauthorizing the 1996 welfare reform bill, the bill, the funding for the bill runs out in October of 2002, and so Congress needs to reauthorize the spending. It's unclear at this point whether or not that will occur, and if they don't, then there won't be, then there certainly will not be any extra funds for welfare over the next year, right when states need the money the most.
Let's get back to the reauthorization in a moment, but one more thing, the child care issue.
Yes.
How important is that to the fate of women who leave welfare?
Oh, it's critical. I mean, you cannot stress enough how important the child care issue is to these former welfare recipients. I mean, virtually by definition, former welfare recipients are single mothers, and they're single moms who don't have a lot of money and who may live in communities where they don't have access to really high-quality child care, but getting high-quality, affordable child care into their communities and making it available to them is the, you know, one of the best things that we can do to help these mothers stay employed and to provide these kids with the kind of environment that will help them to thrive and grow.
And I'm guessing it's not cheap to do that either, is it?
No, it's not cheap to do that either, but I think that the costs are pretty high. So in thinking about whether or not you want to make an investment in kids and the capacity of their moms to work now versus the kinds of problems that you can see down the road if mothers don't have access to this kind of child care, I think we find that this is a really good investment.
I'm speaking with Heather Boucher, who's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute and author of a study just published by EPI, Staying Employed After Welfare. And you mentioned the reauthorization of TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, coming up later this year. How's the politics of that shaping up?
Well, it's been rather disappointing from our perspective in some ways. The House passed, let me actually take a step back. President Bush suggested a reauthorization plan in the late spring, in about April or May, that was passed pretty much in its the same form as the Bush administration proposed it. And that bill on the House side increases the work requirements for people who are on welfare to up to 40 hours a week and reduces the number of hours per week that people can be in education or training activities, reduces the kinds of activities that they can count towards that work requirement. So it really increases the difficulty for folks when they're on welfare in being able to get education or training, and increases the amount of time that they have to work without increasing the amount of money available for child care, which is really just a tragedy. Right now, only about one out of every eight children who is eligible to receive federal subsidies for child care actually receives any money because states don't have programs and because there's not enough funding available. That's one out of every eight, and yet the Bush administration and the House passed the bill that doesn't increase funding. Now, on the Senate side, the bill hasn't come to a full vote, but it has sort of worked its way through the Senate Finance Committee and has been passed by them. Fortunately, they do not increase the work hours up to 40 hours a week, but leave it at 30 and actually increase the kinds of activities that folks can do on welfare to count towards those work hours, including education and training and substance abuse counseling. So the Senate bill is not nearly as bad. Unfortunately, though, although the Senate bill does increase funding for child care, it's far below what folks think is necessary. It's about half as much as the Children's Defense Fund believes is necessary to provide enough child care for all the needy children who need it.
You mentioned the effects of the recession on former welfare recipients, but let's talk more broadly about the labor market. From on the surface of things, this is a mild recession. The increase in unemployment has been rather small by historical standards. Is it as mild as it looks at first glance?
Oh, it's really not as mild as it looks at first glance. I mean, you are right in that the growth in unemployment from its low of 3.9 up to where it is at right now at 5.9. So the 2 percentage point increase in unemployment is actually smaller than the increase in unemployment that we saw in the recession of the early 1990s, where unemployment increased by 2.6%. And it also started off at a higher level, so that unemployment reached a much higher level than it appears that it will during this recession. But unemployment is just one piece of the story. We have seen actually larger decreases in employment rates during this recession than we did during the last recession. And you have to remember that these numbers only go through June 2002, and the recession is probably not over in terms of increasing unemployment and decreasing employment, even if it's over according to sort of manufacturers or Greenspan. It doesn't necessarily mean that unemployment won't continue to rise. During the recession of the early 1990s, unemployment continued to rise for a full year and a half after the recession was declared officially over. So the employment losses have been larger, not substantially larger, but they have been larger by, I believe, in the recession of the early 1990s, employment rates decreased by about a percentage and a half, whereas now they've decreased by almost 2 percentage points.
That is employment versus the entire adult population.
Right, right. So that really means that although folks are losing their jobs, they're not necessarily searching for jobs immediately. So that's sort of the difference between the relatively low rise in unemployment and the relatively large drop in employment rates. And a lot of this, I think, is related to the fact that the labor force participation rate spiked up rather dramatically in the latter half of the 1990s, especially among women and African-American women and Hispanic women in particular. So those folks who maybe were drawn into the really tight labor markets of the late 1990s are perhaps sort of falling back out of the labor market now and are less likely to be searching for work immediately. But that certainly doesn't mean that the economy is doing well. It means that these people don't feel that they can find a job right now, so they're not necessarily looking.
And you also mentioned the importance of child care for welfare recipients or former welfare recipients, but there are an awful lot of working class, middle income people who'd say, well, I'd like some child care too. Is it really a politically promising just to focus the need for child care on the very poorest of the population?
No, I think you've really hit on something important there, Doug. It seems that we've spent all of this attention over the past few years focusing on the 2 to 5% of the population who receives welfare, and really ignoring the needs of the broad swath of working Americans who need access to safe and enriching and affordable child care, but who also need access to income support when they don't have a job. In two issues in particular, the unemployment insurance system is still very biased towards women workers and towards low-wage workers, so that when people are unemployed, the folks who are most likely to actually qualify and receive unemployment insurance still happen to be the higher-paid workers, the white workers, the male workers. So low-wage workers and even sort of middle-to-low-wage workers aren't able to access this benefit to the same degree, and we need to rethink that.
Yeah, only about half the people who are unemployed are actually drawing unemployment benefits.
Well, it's actually closer to 40%. So it's really not an income support that's available to all Americans. At the other end, many folks use welfare because of the birth of a child or a new child in the home. Use it as a form of paid family and medical leave because half of the U.S. population still doesn't even have access to unpaid family and medical leave, let alone paid family and medical leave. And one of the things that we've been looking at here and that will appear in the State of Working America is the fact that we are one of the only advanced countries that don't offer any paid family and medical leave for low-wage workers or for middle and high-wage workers. And really reforming that bill passed by President Clinton back in 1993 to offer income support to folks for paid maternity and paternity leave is really a critical step towards helping families make ends meet. Not to mention, as you said, the child care issue, which there's certainly not enough child care slots for all the families that need them here in the United States, be they poor or middle class.
And is this a lonely position in Washington, or are there people, powerful people, taking your side?
Oh, I think that there's plenty taking our side. The National Employment Law Project has been doing fabulous work here in Washington on the unemployment insurance issue, and there's tons of groups that are trying to promote what they call the baby UIs, using the unemployment insurance system to provide paid family medical leave out in the states. I know Washington State has been thinking about it. And there's a number of other states that have been where advocacy groups are really working towards encouraging that and sort of letting go of welfare as the key issue around income support, but looking more broadly at the kinds of income support that families across the income distribution need.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Heather Boucher, who is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and author of Staying Employed After Welfare, which is available on the EPI website, www.epinet.org. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening, and let's go out with this advice for coordinated global action from the coup.
Load and bait them with the dough. You can do it funk or do it disco. See how this go. Bay Area, get ready to brawl. Bay Area, you ready to brawl. L.A., get ready to brawl. L.A., are you ready to brawl? Chi-Town, get ready to brawl. Chi-Town, are you ready to brawl? Detroit, Detroit, are you ready to brawl? Detroit, are you ready to brawl? Atlanta, are you ready to brawl? Atlanta,